Medicom Medical Publishers produces peer-reviewed reports and highlights on major medical meetings. We bring the Congress to the physician.
Welcome to this podcast brought to you by Medicom Medical Publishers. My name is Dr. Rachel Giles, and today we're going to talk about six of the presentations from the European College of Neuropsychopharmacology, or the ECNP 2021, which was held virtually from the 2nd through the 5th of October 2021. Enjoy listening.
Thank you to all the healthcare professionals who have worked so hard to bring us through the current pandemic.
The waterfall study of zuranolone was considered fairly pivotal, and it looked at patients with major depressive disorder, or MDD, and whether they had a clinically meaningful reduction in depressive symptoms after 15 days. So zuranolone is a novel oral neuroactive steroid, and it's a GABA-A receptor-positive allosteric modulator. Zuranolone is under investigation as a two-week therapy for patients with MDD or with postpartum depression. And in the Phase 3 waterfall study, the efficacy and safety of zuranolone at 50 milligrams was compared to placebo in the 543 adults with MDD with a total score of greater than or equal to 24 on the 17-item Hamilton Rating Scale for Depression, better known as the HAMD-17. Participants were randomized 1-to-1 to receive zuranolone, so that was 271 patients, or placebo, 272 patients, once daily for 2 weeks. Pre-existing antidepressants could be continued at a stable dose. The primary endpoint was a statistically significant change from the baseline, CFB, in HAMD-17 at day 15. This endpoint was met with a difference of minus 1.7 points in favor of zuranolone versus placebo, with a significant p-value of 0.01. At all measured time points through day 42, HAMD-17 results demonstrated a numerical improvement in depressive symptoms versus placebo. The difference reached nominal significance at days 3, 8, and 12, all with a p-value less than 0.001. The SF36 version 2 patient-reported outcome measure collected during the double-blinded period demonstrated that treatment with zuranolone improved quality of life and overall health across nearly all functioning and well-being domains at day 15. Perceived improvements continued after completion of the treatment at day 42 as well. Zuranolone was generally well tolerated and demonstrated a safety profile consistent across the zuranolone clinical development program. The rate of treatment emergent adverse events was 60.1% versus 44.6% in the placebo group. The severity of almost all observed treatment emergent adverse events was mild to moderate in both groups, 95% of patients versus 97.5% patients in the experimental versus placebo group. The most common adverse events in the zuranolone versus placebo group were somnolence, 15.3% versus 3.0%, dizziness, so nearly 14% versus 2.2%, headache, 2.8% versus 7.8%, and sedation, 7.5% versus 0.4%. This data continues to support the development of zuranolone as a potential two-week treatment for MDD episodes. This next presentation is actually sort of a combination of two different posters, one from Agnese Merlo and the other from Pauline Hendrickson. And this was an online survey among the Dutch population to investigate the impact of the COVID-19 lockdown on alcohol consumption. And they saw, unfortunately, that roughly a quarter of participants drank less than before lockdown. Half of them didn't alter their intake, but a quarter of the population drank more alcohol. So using the number of drinks and drinking days per week as data on alcohol intake, that was collected for about the 3 months preceding the first Dutch lockdown, which was the 15th of January through the 14th of March 2020, and during the first lockdown, which was the 15th of March to the 11th of May 2020. Also, outcomes that were measured were stress on a scale of 0 to 10, how individuals cope with stress using the subscale of the Fantastic Lifestyle Checklist, perceived immune fitness on a scale of 1 to 10, and COVID-19 symptoms and severity rated as none being 0, mild being 1, moderate being 2, or severe being 3. So for each variable differences, the delta between the lockdown and the pre-lockdown were calculated. Of the 761 included participants, mean age was 42 years and 62% were women. The lockdown period was associated with poor mood, so including anxiety, depression, loneliness, and increased stress. And all of those numbers were with a p-value of under 0.0001. Both the Delta stress scores and the coping with stress scores correlated significantly with the quantity and frequency of alcohol consumption. There are also significant correlations between, on the one hand, the Delta perceived immune fitness, and on the other hand, the Delta stress, the Delta coping with stress, and the quantity, although not the frequency, of alcohol consumption. About half the participants, 50.4%, did not alter weekly alcohol consumption during the lockdown. 25.9% reported a decrease, and 23.8% reported an increase. The latter group experienced the highest increase in stress with a p-value that was significant and performed poorest in coping with stress with a p-value of less than 0.001. So of note, increased alcohol consumption was associated with poor perceived immune fitness and with a higher presence and severity of COVID-19 symptoms. The authors assume this may be explained by their applying less effective strategies for lockdown-related stress. A critical review of studies that evaluated the impact of COVID-19 lockdowns on alcohol consumption yielded similar results in the second poster. So they included 31 studies with a total of 94,630 participants. Taken together, the findings showed that during COVID-19 lockdown, about half of the individuals did not change their alcohol intake. About a quarter increased their alcohol consumption during the lockdown, which was associated with negative mood, increased stress, poorer health, and increased susceptibility to COVID-19 symptoms. Stress and coping with stress were important determinants of alcohol intake during this period. I also wanted to spend some time on the RECONNECT study that looks at the effectiveness of vortioxetine, which was either provided at 10 or 20 milligrams per day in patients with major depressive disorder, comorbid with generalized anxiety disorder. This was a poster P0073 at the ECNP, and it was presented by Michael Christensen from Denmark. In patients with severe comorbid major depressive disorder, MDD, and comorbid generalized anxiety disorder, or GAD, 8 weeks of treatment with vortioxetine resulted in clinically and significantly reduced symptoms of both depression and anxiety. MDD frequently has GAD as a comorbidity, and there's a partial overlap in the clinical symptoms as well. And patients with both of these conditions, on average, suffer more severe symptoms and greater impairment in functioning, as well as their health-related quality of life. In addition, treatment is less successful in this subgroup, and treatment duration can be longer, and remission rate is overall quite lower. In this multi-center RECONNECT trial, it was an open-label study in adult outpatients. The effectiveness of vortioxetine at 10 or 20 milligrams per day in patients with MDD presenting with comorbid GAD was assessed. Patients had a DSM-5 diagnosis of MDD and GAD and a current major depressive episode of less than or equal to 12 months. A total score of greater than or equal to 22 on the Montgomery-Åsberg Depression Rating Scale that matters, and a total score of greater than or equal to 20 on the Hamilton Anxiety Rating Scale, so the HAM-A scale. The starting dose of vortioxetine was 10 milligrams per day, and it was doubled after a week. Both clinicians and patients assessed changes in the symptoms. The study's primary endpoint was the change in the MADRS, as assessed by clinicians. So once again, that's the Montgomery-Åsberg Depression Rating Scale. They also employed the HAM-A, the anxiety tool. Clinical Global Impression Scale and Functioning Assessment Short Test, the FAST test, were also used. Patients evaluated their own symptoms of depression and anxiety by means of the Hospital Anxiety and Depression Scale, the HADS, and the Health-Related Quality of Life using the Quality of Life Employment and Satisfaction Questionnaire, long form, the Q-less-Q. A total of 100 patients received 8 weeks of study treatment with vortioxetine, 77 of whom were switching from prior therapy. Mostly those were SSRIs, and that was 58 of those 100 patients. Statistically and clinically significant improvements in symptoms of depression and anxiety, functioning, and health-related quality of life were observed with all very positive p-values when compared to baseline levels. After 8 weeks, 60.8% of patients were MADRS responsors, with a greater than or equal to 50% decrease in the total MADRS score, and 35.1% of that cohort were in remission, so a total MADRS score of less than or equal to 10. The rate of HAM-A responders, so that's a greater than or equal to 50% decrease in the HAM-A score, was 54.6%, while 43.2% were in remission, with a total HAM-A score of less than or equal to 10. Rates of patients who on both scales achieved response and remission were 50% and 30% respectively. HAM-A and MADRS scores were significantly correlated with the FAST total score and Q-less-Q general activity score, both of which were highly significant. Fortioxetine was really well tolerated as well. The most common treatment emergent adverse event was nausea, but that was fairly common at 21%. Two patients withdrew from treatment due to adverse events. So overall, the RECONNECT study sounds like it's pretty impressive, with a 50% response rate and a 30% remission rate on some of the important outcomes. Interesting study. Turning to schizophrenia, there was an interesting story from Michael Davidson from Minerva Neurosciences in Massachusetts, United States, who looked at roluperidone. So the unmet need here is that there's no approved drug to specifically treat primary negative symptoms in schizophrenia. Roluperidone, which is also called MIN-101, has high affinities for a specific subtype of serotonin receptor called 5-HT2A. It's a sigma receptor subtype called sigma-2 and the alpha-adrenergic subtype alpha-1A, which are involved in regulating mood, cognition, sleep, and anxiety. It was designed to avoid direct blockade of dopaminergic, cholinergic, and histaminergic receptors. Following a multinational phase 2B trial involving 244 patients with positive results, a confirmatory phase 3 trial was conducted and presented here at the ECNP. Participants were 513 patients with moderate to severe negative symptoms of schizophrenia. They were randomized 1:1:1 with roluperidone at 32 milligrams per day, 64 milligrams per day, or with placebo for 12 weeks. They could then enter a 4-week open-label extension period designed to evaluate the safety of long-term exposure to roluperidone. Patients who had received roluperidone continued to receive the same dose, while patients who had received placebo were re-randomized to either 32 or 64 milligrams per day. The primary endpoint was the positive and negative syndrome scale, the PANSS, with two S's, P-A-N-S-S, derived negative symptoms factor score, so the NSFS. The key secondary endpoint was personal and social performance, PSP, total score. After 12 weeks, the negative NSFS scores were more favorable on roluperidone 64 milligrams compared with placebo for the modified intent-to-treat population, with a significant p-value but not super strong at 0.044. It was modified because data contributed by one center was unreliable and therefore excluded PSP total score was statistically significant superior on roluperidone 64 milligrams than on placebo. An unexplained difference between the phase 2 and phase 3 trial was the magnitude of the placebo effect, which was notably higher in the phase 3 trial. A total of 333 patients, which was about 65% of the total cohort, entered the open-label extension period of the phase 3 trial. 166 were treated with a 32 milligram dose and 167 with the 64 milligram dose. And of those 333 patients, 202, so 61%, completed the 40-week period. Negative symptoms, daily functioning, and total PANSS scores, PANSS, continued to improve, while positive symptoms remained stable. A low dropout rate due to the relapse of 11.7% overall was observed during the 52 weeks of the study. Roluperidone was well tolerated without major or unexpected adverse events. Always a popular topic is the use of cannabidiol for cannabis cessation, and the first randomized clinical trial of cannabidiol or CBD for cannabis use disorder was reported at this meeting. So this was presented by Dr. Tom Freeman from the University of Bath, the United Kingdom. Dr. Freeman started off by saying, quote, addiction to cannabis has seen a large rise over the last decade and has emerged as the primary reason for first-time admission to drug addiction treatment, end quote. This rise really mirrors the increasing potency of cannabis in Europe, which has made it more harmful and addictive. Cannabis use disorder affects about 22% of cannabis users and is characterized by a problematic pattern of use with clinically significant impairment or distress such as craving, tolerance, or inability to control use. A substantial and unmet clinical need exists for pharmacological treatment of cannabis use disorders, and CBD could offer a novel treatment. So to this end, a randomized double-blind placebo-controlled adaptive Bayesian trial was designed to eliminate or retain doses based on efficacy. The two primary endpoints both measured changes in cannabis use. The first endpoint was biological reduction, so reduced urinary THC to creatinine ratio. The second endpoint was self-reported reduction, so days of abstinence. All participants underwent motivational interviewing and were randomized to placebo, and there were 12 in that group, CBD at 200 milligrams, there were 12 in that group, CBD 400 milligrams, 12 in that group as well, or CBD 800 milligrams, also 12 in that group. At interim analysis after 24 weeks, CBD 200 milligrams was found to be ineffective and was eliminated from the trial. And in the second stage, an additional 34 participants were randomized to placebo, CBD 400 milligrams, and there were 12 of them, or CBD 800 milligrams, and there were 11 of those. At final analysis, CBD 400 and 800 milligrams met both primary endpoints. For urinary THC to creatinine ratio, the probability of being the most efficacious dose versus placebo had a high certainty of 0.9995 for CBD 400 and 0.9965 for 800 milligrams. Secondary endpoints showed mixed findings. Some evidence was found for reduction in cannabis withdrawal symptoms, tobacco use, and depression and anxiety symptoms following CBD compared with placebo. No change in alcohol use following CBD was found, and some evidence indicated poor sleep versus placebo. Safety and compliance were both excellent. Dr. Freeman warned that these results really should not be generalized to CBD wellness products. Connecting, challenging, and empowering the youth through their smartphone seems like a great idea. And there was a study presented by Professor Manon Hillegers from the Sophia Hospital for Children, connected with the Erasmus Medical Center in Rotterdam, the Netherlands. It's called Grow It! Exclamation point. It's a multiplayer, serious gaming app for adolescents aged 12 to 25 years old. And of course, it was developed here in the Netherlands. She addressed the scientific basis, development, and game mechanics of the Grow It! Gaming app. Development started in 2016. The app monitors thoughts and emotions in daily life by utilizing the Experience Sampling Method, or ESM, to identify emotion profiles and increase self-insight. It offers daily cognitive behavioral therapy, CBT-based challenges, to promote adaptive coping and provides motivating gaming elements. It is non-stigmatizing, and it can be implemented on a large scale, with more than 96% of adolescents in the Netherlands having a smartphone, of course. The study was carried out during two lockdowns in 2020, and it looked at the e-health intervention options for this particular approach. Professor Hillegers said, quote, "You participate anonymously, you choose a nickname, and you play for a team of 5 to 8 adolescents. Together, you grow a tree, you compete with other teams, and earn points by completing questionnaires on emotion, so ESM, which enhance insight into emotion, and by completing daily challenges, it can help you cope with stress." The Grow It! Exclamation point app was about to be released when COVID-19 crisis broke out, upon which the longitudinal Grow It! COVID-19 study was carried out to evaluate the app. There were 3,153 participants, three quarters of which were girls, and the mean age was 17.9 years, in two cohorts. The first cohort was recruited during the first lockdown around May 2020, and there were 1,282 people in that cohort, and the second cohort was around the time of the second lockdown in December 2020, and there were 1,871 participants in that cohort. The results showed that at an individual level, affective and cognitive well-being increased 41 to 53% of the adolescents who participated. So some of the take-home message that Professor Hillegers brought home to the audience were that adolescents are at high risk for mood disorders, and they have a distinct emotional profile that can be identified. Next, adolescents want to share but prefer not to talk about emotions. Thirdly, smartphones can be used really well to reach and offer help and feedback on emotions to adolescents. Next, developing and testing gamified e-health tools in co-creation with youth will enhance insight into needs, motivation, and promote better preventative effects. That's it for our podcast today. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and stay healthy.
This podcast was produced by Medicom Medical Publishers.